content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to another edition of Salute a Veteran Every Day, underwritten by RBR Physical Therapy, located at 1300 Corporation Parkway, Suite B, Raleigh. Call 919-917-7729 for more information. Our guest today is a friend of mine, John Lewis. He's an 11-year Air Force veteran. John lives in Raleigh, but he's from...
College Station, Texas.
Okay, John. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Tell us what bases you were assigned at and what you did there.
Sure. My first tour of duty was Clark Air Base in the Philippines, where I was a crew chief on fighter jets, part of the aggressor squadron. So the airplanes I worked on were painted up like the Russian airplanes, and they would go and fly air combat mission, training missions against U.S. pilots.
Oh, man. I see I'm hearing that for the first time.
Yeah.
I'm sure you know what the red flag exercise is.
It was very similar to the red flag. So the other aggressor squadron was in Nevada, and we were the ones in the Far East.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a sister squadron.
I was involved in the very beginning of that.
Oh,
and we had very ancient video equipment, but we're making lessons learned. So great to bring friends together and learn something new. Where'd you go next?
After I left the Clark Air Base, I went to Reese Air Force Base in Lubbock, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked on T-38 trainer jets, same type of crew chief position, yeah.
And the T-38 is used as the aggressors, right?
The F-5s are used as the aggressors,
that's
but
right.
That's the fighter version of the T-38, right? So T-38's no guns and no radar, so it's a trainer, first supersonic trainer jet that Air Force pilots use.
You're fighting with electronic bullets.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got a ride in one time.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's quite a thrill. It is very unusual for your first assignment to go overseas, but this must have been during Vietnam.
No, in 1980, my buddy and I, we were just out of high school, and we enlisted in the Air Force. We went in on the buddy program, and so we had it guaranteed all the way through to Clark Air Base, where we were stationed together and actually ended up in the same unit, working on the same type of jets and everything together.
Gosh, how about that?
It was pretty nice.
Anybody I know?
Nope. hometown boy from College Station, Texas.
College Station. Any stories from the Philippines that you can tell on the radio? The family program.
Right. No. Well, the Philippines, it was really a pretty nice place to live. But, you know, what I remember, it's so cold here now in February in Raleigh is in the Philippines. Cold was like 70 degrees, but in the rainy season, when it got down to 70, it was funny because everyone was breaking out the, you know, the heavy coats and stuff like that because it's normally, you know, 95 and humid or better. So when it got down to 70, it was, people thought it was cold.
Yeah, I have that memory too. I was stationed there for 2 years and the coldest coat, quote unquote, it ever got was 70.
Right, right.
You're right. They're in mufflers and gloves and everything.
Yeah, that's crazy.
You must have been the fighter wing there.
I was. I don't remember what it was. Anyway, we were, you know, detached from the main wing, and we had our little section of the runway and the flight line and stuff, very separated. So smaller unit, but we traveled throughout the Far East, Korea and Japan, Okinawa, to let our jets fly against the fighter pilots of those bases.
Yeah. Did you ever get a ride in one?
I never did,
but
I always wanted one.
But you kept them running.
Right.
Well, for our listeners, just a little bit of inside ball. The Air Force is divided up into major commands and then numbered Air Force. So at Clark Air Base, Philippines, it was the 13th Air Force, and then there was a fighter wing there, called, I believe, the 13th Fighter Wing.
Something like that, yeah.
And then there was a military airlift command that had C-130s. They were the 374th, I believe. Don't ask me what I had for breakfast, but I do remember that, the 374th Airlift Wing.
I flew on a few of the C-130s from there, so.
Yeah, I think everybody did.
Yeah, had to.
any exciting stories with the aggressor squadron or wing?
Oh, you know, when we went to Okinawa, we were where we parked our planes, our jets. It was pretty close to the end of the ramp and end of the runway, and it seems like every time we were there, like on a Friday, they would shut the ramp down, shut the runway down, and F-15 would go out and start practicing for air shows. And we had like a front row seat to that whenever we were there on a Friday afternoon or something. And it was like we just shut down and started watching the air show. He was just practicing, but it was, you know, right in front of us, so we got to take a good advantage of that. So.
I don't think I've ever seen a more beautiful sky than in the Philippines. Beautiful blue with those big white puffy clouds.
Right, right.
Yeah, it's nice.
We did, you know, do some things like scuba diving and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So got to travel around the big island of Luzon some. I have an interesting story. We traveled up to the very northern tip of Luzon one time. I was with one other American guy, and then the rest of them were Filipinos. The Filipino guys were actually in the U.S. Air Force. And so we took a trip up to the very northern part of Luzon, and we stayed at this coconut plantation, but we were basically just camping out on the beach, right?
Mm-hmm.
And nearby there was a Catholic mission, right? And there's a lot of little kids, the Filipino kids.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they had never seen an American because they were that young,
uh-huh.
Right?
Yeah.
And so we were out in the water and swimming with all these, with the priests from the mission and all these little kids, and the kids were fascinated by how hairy my arms were, and they wouldn't let them go. Like, they would just stand in the water and play with my arms,
yeah,
because they were very hairless, you know, folks, and it was just fascinating to these little kids. So it was really fun to be with them that day.
Yeah, and scuba diving is something you can do very inexpensively.
In the Philippines, it was fabulous.
And beautiful, beautiful diving and snorkeling even.
You didn't have to go very far to see, you know, all the colors and the beauty of that area.
So. In the South China Sea, it's like bathwater.
Right, right.
I'm a little wimpy about getting in cold water. But
that's where it was, South
you go
China
right
Sea.
In.
And just, yeah, the most beautiful place in the world. So.
So from Clark Air Base, which was pretty much decimated by the explosion of eruption of Mount Pinatubo.
Pinatubo, right.
Back around 91-ish.
Right.
Yeah. You weren't there then, were you?
I was not. I was there just before that happened.
Before. Mm-hmm. So where'd you go after that, after Clark?
Right. I went to Reese Air Force Base in Lubbock, Texas, mm-hmm. and it was a ATC, Air Training Command base, and they had all T-38s there. So I chose Reese Air Force Base because it was I was ready to start my college career, and there was Texas Tech was mm-hmm. there. So while I was stationed there, I got to start my college.
Mm-hmm. Plus, being a Texan,
yep,
you get drawn back to Texas.
Right.
After that, I believe you got out of the Air Force for a while.
Yeah, I was out for a year. I transferred from Texas Tech to Texas A&M. That's mm-hmm. where I'm from. Mm-hmm. So I started going to Texas A&M. And then I got a letter from the 433rd was the military airlift wing in San Antonio, Texas. They were looking for former crew chiefs to help them transition from the C-130 aircraft to the C-5 Galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
And they were looking for former crew chiefs to go into the flight engineer program. So I applied, I got accepted, and then I had to, you know, stop going to college for a little while, which really, you know, upset my mother because she thought I was never going to come back.
Uh-huh.
But when I had to go to flight school for 18 months in Oklahoma, and then after that I went back to Texas A&M and finished my college. But while I was at A&M, I was in the Air Force Reserve flying out of San Antonio.
Outstanding.
It was a lot of fun.
Did that help pay for your education?
They did. They paid a lot of the books and mm-hmm. stuff like that, yeah.
So when you went for that training in Oklahoma, I'm guessing it was Altus, Oklahoma.
Altus, Oklahoma.
That was my first base.
Oh, really? Wow.
Thought I was going to cry when I rolled in there.
Well, we were very busy, so it didn't matter, right? So
turned out to be a great, great base, though.
Yeah.
We helped with some of the training also. And Altus is just a very warm place. I have friends there. I still go back to see.
Yeah.
You know, it's
mm-hmm.
a great place. And then next base was?
San Antonio, Kelly Air Force Base,
mm-hmm.
right. So the whole time I was on the C-5 Galaxy, I was stationed at San Antonio at mm-hmm. Kelly Air Force Base.
Now that's C-5. Tell us about the size of that, a little bit of some specs and stuff. I used to, as an additional duty, be the base Boy Scout officer, so I took a lot of people on tours of it, but you
right.
probably remember it better than I do.
Well, it's, you know, basically it's the largest airplane in the U.S. inventory at the time,
mm-hmm.
About the size of a 747, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the cockpit's about 30 feet off the ground. The cargo compartment holds 6 Greyhound buses, so you've probably seen, you know, some pictures of that. We're all lined up. And the cool thing about the C5 is you could kneel it and front and back, so you could just drive up into the cargo compartment, right? So more than 200 feet wingspan. And it was just a huge plane. So, but it was, you know, if you're flying in the Air Force, it was very comfortable as an air crew position. So,
I always remember this. The wingspan of the C-5 is longer than the Wright brothers'
first flight. That's
maybe
right.
The second.
Right.
And also the landing gear,
28 tires,
yeah.
Right.
Uh-huh.
4 in the front and 24 main gear. So 4 pods, 4 main pods with 6 tires each. Yeah.
Wow. And can't they, what's the term, can't them? So if they're coming in and it's windy?
Yeah, we could. We could, so we would turn the airplane, it was called a crosswind landing system. And so the airplane could be lined up in the wind, which could be canted from the runway, and the wheels on the airplane could be lined up with the runway. So you could land almost sideways. It wasn't really, I mean, it was just about, you know, 10 degrees off or something like that. I did that once. So the whole time I was flying, we only had to do it once, but it was interesting.
I bet. It probably looks scary doing it.
The pilots have to be very comfortable, you know, and in command of what they're doing. So
one of the first, if not the first, simulator was at Altus.
Right.
Lockheed installed it.
Uh-huh.
I met a guy at the swimming pool who, a civilian from Lockheed, we ended up becoming good friends.
Cool.
Bernie something. He let me, we went over there, he let me fly it.
Yeah, fly
it. I'm making air quotes, fly it, you know.
Well, we spent a lot of time in the simulator. We had to do almost everything simulator before we could do anything in real airplane. So as a student, pilots and flight engineers have to do a lot of simulator time, practicing emergencies and just basic takeoff and landing procedures before you can even get close to their real airplane. So.
Now, I imagine you got to be pretty smart to do that in the sciences and...
The flight school was, you know, how airplanes fly, a lot of principal stuff like that for how planes fly. But for the flight engineer, there was also, you know, here's the systems of the airplane. So the flight engineer's job was the systems expert while the airplane was flying. Right. So the pilots were in control of the plane and the avionics. We were controlled and had switches for every other system, generators, hydraulic systems, everything like that. So, and any troubleshooting that we had to do in flight, the engineers were the one that got real busy doing that.
Tremendous amount of responsibility. And
it was a great job.
I imagine you were fairly young then.
I was. I was in my 20s.
Not so grizzly like you are now.
That's right.
So where from, okay, where are some of the places you flew to?
Oh, the C-5 was really worldwide, so all over the Far East, Thailand, back to the Philippines, Korea, Japan. I actually went to Baghdad before the first Gulf War. The Middle East, you know, now there's bases all over that, so I've been to most of those places that'll handle a C-5, Bahrain and Saudi. And then some cold places, you know, Keflavik, Iceland was, we got stuck there one night and it was so cold. We were, you know, not prepared for staying overnight there, but we got to go to Honduras, South America. I was asked to go on a trip to Australia, but I was about to graduate college. So I was like, well, timing is just bad. So I couldn't make the Australia trip, but all over the South Pacific, it was, you know, a lot of fun.
Any interesting stories from those trips? Interesting cargo?
Well, you know, the cargo was covered up with plastic or something most of the time, but unless it was helicopters or vehicles, we could see it. But most of it was under, you know, pretty heavy plastic or tarp, so we couldn't really see what it was. But I know that one time we were coming into Saudi Arabia, this was during the first Gulf War, and the people on the ground were actually taking bets on how many M&Ms we were carrying today. So whether we were actually carrying them or not, I have no idea, but they were betting on how many M&Ms we were going to unload for them, because I guess they were craving some chocolate that day or something. So.
That's, had a friend on the C5 to bring him M&Ms, apparently.
Right.
And then you went over for the first Gulf War, right?
I was activated. I had just graduated college, and I was working at my first job for 3 months. And I remember when I interviewed with this job, I actually told the guy that hired me, I said, I've just got to, you know, make sure you know that I'm in the Air Force Reserve and I could be activated, but my unit hasn't been activated since Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And 3 months later, I was gone. Activated and gone.
Timing is everything.
Right. So I was activated for a year for the first Gulf War. And it's not like when you're an air crew, you don't go over there the whole time, right? You're flying back and forth worldwide. So the first 3 months, I was flying out of the Far East, Honolulu and Thailand. And then the next 3 months, I was flying out of Germany. And then 3 months, I was flying out of Torjon, Spain. So we were kind of positioned around the globe. And whenever we would sort of empty out the supplies from that area, we would just go somewhere else.
So. Mm-hmm. I'm so jealous of that. I think I'm the only guy in the Air Force who's never been to Germany.
Right, right.
And, of course, while you're there, you're partaking of the local food and drink.
Yeah, it was interesting. During the first Gulf War, the air crews for at least my portion of the crew, the C-5s and some of the larger cargo planes, we were restricted from going off base because of the terrorist threat to air crews. Mm-hmm. So we were pretty much isolated to the base, but they still took care of us. When our off-duty time, which totally wasn't that much. But you know.
Well, how about when you're in these other countries, you know, to pick up cargo or people, you must have had time there.
On the first 3 months, we were basically flying everything out of the Far East. So a plane would come in from Honolulu, for example, and land in Thailand. And then they would just swap crews.
Mm-hmm.
So then we would take the plane from Thailand into Saudi Arabia and back in 1 day.
Mm-hmm.
It was 16 to 24 hours every time you did that. Mm-hmm. So it was a long day.
Yeah.
Right. But the C-5 had bunks and, mm-hmm. you know, we could take some crew rest there. But once we were off duty in Thailand, we were actually staying at a resort that was right on the beach.
Tough.
And it was pretty tough, and we were the only ones there, so the resort was just for us. So we ate really good, and Thailand has some pretty good beverages and stuff like that. So,
mm-hmm.
But the resort right on the beach, and the last day I was there, I was the last C-5 to leave that area. So it took us a couple extra days to load up all the remaining gear and put it on the last plane out, and so we had like 3 days of just hanging out at the beach. Did a little deep sea fishing right there in the huge bay we were at, and then the driver of the captain of the boat, I guess, that was taking us fishing. We caught a whole bunch of fish that day, and he took us off to some little island, and they took all of our fish and took it up. And on the island there was a big like a pavilion party kind of place, and they cooked it all up, and rice and fish and some extras, and we had a huge feast.
You're making me hungry.
It was fabulous, yeah.
Now, I'm trying to guide you toward a story you told me about landing that C-5 in an unusual parking space.
Right, right. Okay, so after the shooting stopped in the first Gulf War, what had happened before that was the Iraqis, they set all the oil rigs on fire in Kuwait.
Yeah,
right?
I remember that looked like the end of the world.
It did, really, and there was just thousands of them on fire. Mm-hmm. So they had planes positioned ready to go that were already loaded with extra oil rig caps and some firefighting equipment, stuff like that, to put out all those oil rig fires. Well, I was fortunate enough to be on the first plane into Kuwait after the shooting stopped. So we took one of those pre-positioned planes that was loaded with oil rig caps, and we flew into Kuwait City and landed at the airport there. And there was, I mean, it was barely cleared off,
mm-hmm.
right? So it was just barely enough space for the C-5 to taxi and stuff like that. So we were following.
Was there somebody on the ground to make sure there's no debris on the runway?
It looked like they had just barely cleared enough for us to land, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they had, we just parked on the taxiway after we got off the runway. So there was some Marines, I think there were Marines on the base there. And there was one follow me truck. So the follow me truck is, you know, gets in front of the aircraft. And when that truck stops, that's where you park.
Mm-hmm.
So we were driving down the taxiway and following the follow me truck.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, stop here. And so I was the second engineer on the flight that day. So I get to open the door. And when I open the door, a Marine from, you know, Humvee or something comes up and starts yelling at me and using every bit of profanity that he can muster there and saying, why am I parking this airplane here? You can't park this airplane. You got to move this airplane. And yelling, I'm thinking, man, you know, the follow me truck just told us to park here. And he pointed to the number one engine below the number one engine. He said, do you see that there? And he was pointing to a bomb that was sticking up out of the sand.
Jeez.
And all you could see were the four tail fins, but mm-hmm. it was about, you know, a foot or so up. So he was yelling at us that we parked right over an unexploded bomb. And, you know, we were still loaded with fuel and everything. So we gently shut off the engines on that number one side, right, was where the bomb was. And with the other two engines on the right side of the plane, we moved the airplane up far enough away that he was happy. So it was he was part of the EOD team, the Explosive Ordnance Disposal Team,
mm-hmm.
right? And they had them marked, but, you know, we weren't looking for marked.
You were following the follow me truck.
Doing
yeah.
what they were telling
yeah,
us to do. But as we walked around that day, there was, you know, little markers throughout the area
mm-hmm.
that they were getting to eventually.
Now, when you turn the two engines off on one side, does it smoothly go forward with the other two engines? Or you
it really does while you're still going real slow like
okay.
that. So it wasn't a big deal, right?
Wasn't too much stress on the wing?
Nah.
Yeah, okay. Tell me, you're from College Station.
College Station.
So you grew up there?
Since third grade, right.
What's your earliest memory there?
Oh, my goodness. I have really great memories of College Station. It was a real nice place to grow up in. The university was the largest thing there, the biggest employer. And at that time, as you're growing up, this was, man, I probably shouldn't say this, but, you know, in the early 70s and stuff like that. In third grade and all the way through middle school, you could go on campus and, you know, it wasn't all locked down like it is today
mm-hmm.
for security and stuff. So it was a pretty nice place to play. My friends and I, we would just ride our bikes over and, you know, to the campus all the time. And you could get into the stadium, for example, and, you know, it wasn't a big deal. We were just playing. So, the campus was open, though, and it was fun to go over there and, you know, see the college kids and stuff like that.
I remember NC State was like that when I was a freshman. I mean, the buildings were open. That was a cheap date just to take my date to the design school and look at people's
I was in high school.
People's precious projects sitting there.
Yeah, when I was in high school, they would just open up the stadium even during the games, right? So at halftime, they would just open up the stadium. And all my friends and I, we would just go at that point. And, you know, there was a whole section on the end of the stadium sort of in the end zone seating. And we would just all meet there at halftime, and then we mm-hmm. would, you know, let's watch the rest of the game mm-hmm. As a group of, you know, all my friends and stuff. So
how about your family? How many children or...
Right.
Where are you in the lineup?
I have two sisters, one older, one younger. Mm-hmm. My dad worked for Texas A&M, mm-hmm. and my mom worked for Texas A&M while I was in school. In fact, she worked for the registrar, so it was pretty easy for me to get the classes I wanted.
Uh-huh.
So I could just go into her office and get the classes when I wanted it and all that. So
Texas privilege.
Yeah. And my mom still lives there, and both my sisters still live there.
Oh, that's great. I visited there about a year and a half ago. It's just a... I call it gold-plated campus.
Oh, yeah.
Very nice.
Right.
Also went to President Bush's library there.
Fabulous, right.
Yeah,
I have visited.
That's
really, really great.
So how about in high school? What you do in high school? Were you still there?
Yes, I was. It was called A&M Consolidated, and when I was there, it was only one high school. There's several now. But I was just talking about this the other day. When I grew up in College Station, there was only one school for each level. There might have been two element, but the other one was way across town. But so I was basically with the same group of students and kids the whole time from mm-hmm. elementary all the way through high school, right? So
mm-hmm.
You went to school with you know, professor's kids, and we had all the regular groups, but you know, it was you knew everybody.
Yeah. And then what happened after high school?
Right, high school. My buddy and I were working at a hotel. The hotel was closing down, and we weren't quite ready for college yet. So we said, well, let's check out the military. So we actually took all the tests through the Navy, and the Navy wanted us both to come in the Navy, but we wanted to go to the Philippines and learn to scuba dive. So that's what we did. We joined the Air Force and went
to
the Philippines.
That was your motivation.
And while we were there, we did scuba diving.
I love hearing people's motivation to join the military.
That truly was it. I mean,
everyone's a unique story.
Right.
9/11 brought a lot. A female that I worked with at the Defense Information School, she was an artist and had gone to Meredith College. So, and I asked her, and she said every generation in her family had been in the military.
Wow.
And if she didn't, it would break the chain. So right. She came in. They're this very talented artist, and she taught art.
Uh-huh.
You know, the Air Force still teaches art, or the military still has artists for, like, courtroom drawings
Things
like that. So
very
cool.
Very
interesting. But enough about me. Let's get back to you. At what point along the way did you get married?
Well, I actually got married after I got out of the Air Force. So after mm-hmm. I got out of the first Gulf War, after mm-hmm. we were deactivated, I was already working in Dallas. Mm-hmm. Dallas was where I lived and was where I was working, but I was stationed in San Antonio. And part of air crew responsibility is to maintain currency on the airplane. So mm-hmm. In the reserve, you know, if you're an air crew, it's a lot more than one weekend a month and 2 weeks in the year. So for a C-5 air crew, you basically had to go every weekend and to stay current on the airplane, because you could get a check ride anytime. We were training all the time, and if someone popped on and gave you a check ride, or if you're on a trip, they could give you a check ride for the whole trip, mm-hmm. right? They didn't like something you were doing, so you had to know the systems and you had to be up on everything on the airplane all the time. So it took a lot more time. So living in Dallas and working in San Antonio, it was becoming sort of difficult to get mm-hmm. to San Antonio enough. I tried. I still loved it. Flying on the C-5 was really one of the best jobs I've ever had.
Mm-hmm.
And I regretted getting out of the Air Force mm-hmm. at the time, but it was just too difficult to go from Dallas to San Antonio and mm-hmm. fly every weekend. You could never leave Dallas.
When you were in the reserve, were you working full-time?
I was working full-time.
A mm-hmm. civil service?
No, I was a software engineer in Dallas.
Okay.
Right. So I graduated A&M. I got a job in telecommunications as a software engineer,
mm-hmm.
and that was in Dallas. So there was plenty of people that did the civil service to run the outfit, because mm-hmm. We were a reserve unit, so all of the full-time engineers were civil service guys.
I see.
I had I was using my college degree.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was living in Dallas. That's where the job was at the time, and
that's
trying to fly
great.
Out of San Antonio.
And what do you do now?
I'm still a software. I'm in the business, but I have a partner. We have a company that does software consulting.
Say the name of it. Let's give you a plug.
Right. It's Infio Consulting, and we just started about 6 months ago. We've got contracts up in New Jersey right now, and we're looking for more.
And spell the name of the company?
Infio, I-N-F-I-O. It's Latin for sort of new beginning.
Okay.
So.
John, thanks so much for sharing your time with us and your experiences in the Air Force and Reserve and growing up in Texas. Thanks for being on Salute, a Veteran Every Day.
Thank you for having me.
Salute, a Veteran Every Day is underwritten by RBR Physical Therapy. Call 919-917-7729. I'm Frank Urban for the Triangle Radio Reading Service.